Some of us may remember a TV show many years ago, Kids Say the Darndest Things, in which children were asked questions to encourage them to say cute and funny things. Well, I think that sometimes adults say the darndest things, and often they're not cute or funny. 23 years ago, I was walking across the courtyard at the downtown library here in Victoria with my one-year-old daughter in my arms. Suddenly, a young blonde woman dashed out from the library and stopped me. "Are you married to an Indian man?" she demanded breathlessly. Taken aback, I mumbled, "No." "Well, my husband's people are from India, and we have a little girl that looks just like your little girl," she explained. I told her that Alexandra was born in Guatemala and that I had adopted her. "Oh," she said, abruptly changing tact. "How much did she cost?" "My husband and I have talked about adoption, but I understand it's very expensive." I was becoming flustered, even annoyed, and mentioned I had an appointment to get to, and I hurried off. It was a lie, but it was the quickest way I could think of to remove myself from this uncomfortable encounter. Well, my daughter has now grown into a self-assured young woman. I was relaying this story to her the other day, so I asked her if she had ever experienced anything like that about her brown skin or Guatemalan background. Well, she said, "Some people who don't really know me, like shopkeepers or fellow students, are confused about my ethnicity, and I'm often asked, 'What are you?' That's kind of rude," I said. "How does that make you feel?" "Well, it does get annoying sometimes to have to keep explaining my story. When I'm feeling tired and cranky and they ask, 'What are you? Mexican? Pakistani? Iranian?' I just say, 'Yes,' and change the subject." I would say my daughter is comfortable in her own skin and doesn't owe anyone an explanation for its color. And I know that a white woman with a brown child may pique curiosity, but should I feel obliged to answer some pretty personal questions just to satisfy a stranger's curiosity about her background? If the intention is connection, might there be a better way?
Love calls. Unitarian Universalists in Canada and in the States are going through a change. We are a religion that stays relevant to real life, so in response to our changing world, we are, as a movement, going deeper into our work of anti-oppression. The work is not new to us. We have always been progressive. Our most deeply held values are in our first and seventh principles. We affirm the inherent worth and dignity of every person and the interdependent web of existence of which we are all a part. We feel in our bones the truth of Dr. King's words that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We have always been anti-oppressive in our intentions. Lately, though, as a movement, we've been paying more attention to the difference between intention and impact. We are trying to do a better job of listening to and learning from one another, especially those among us with marginalized identities, those among us with the lived experience of oppression, people of color, immigrant, indigenous, genderqueer. I'm sure that you've all had your own journeys of anti-oppression work. You've been to workshops, you've been on marches, maybe you've led workshops and led marches. You know how this work is ever-changing. Many of you have become familiar with the newer vocabulary that's been emerging in the past decade or so, microaggressions, white supremacist culture, white fragility. When I learned these concepts, I found them incredibly helpful because they put a name to something that I sort of felt but couldn't explain. I knew how to talk about obvious oppression, neo-Nazi racism and fundamentalist homophobia. That kind of hatred was easy to identify, which in a way made it easier to fight. What was harder to identify and thus harder to subvert were the subtler and systemic forms of racism and oppression. These are the oppressions we participate in without meaning to. We live in a racist, sexist, colonialist, transphobic, and so on culture, so unwittingly, we absorb all those oppressive assumptions, stereotypes, and prejudices. They lodge in us in ways that are hard to detect and hard to root out. This is the unconscious bias that research has shown results in the hiring of men over women, the hiring of people with white-sounding names over those with non-white-sounding names, and the inferior treatment of Indigenous people and people of color in the healthcare system. In one particularly devastating case in 2016, in the Northwest Territories, an Alakvik elder, Hugh Papik, died of a stroke after he was mistaken for being drunk. Rooting out unconscious bias, discerning the oppressions embedded in our systems and in ourselves is difficult work. It is less satisfying than that righteous, I'm the good guy marching for equal rights kind of feeling. This is the difference between fighting white supremacist people and fighting white supremacist culture. We've talked about this before. White supremacist people are the people who actually think that white people are superior to people of color. White supremacist culture is the culture in which we all live, which slips into our unconscious, our subconscious messages that say white ways of being are superior to non-white ways of being. For example, messages that say that a white way of doing things quickly and efficiently is better than an Indigenous way of taking time to do things, like create and build relationship. I've posted again to our congregation's Facebook group a link that has the full list of white supremacist culture characteristics. Characteristics include a sense of urgency, perfectionism, defensiveness, belief in only one right way, individualism, belief that I'm the only one who can do this right, continual striving after progress defined as bigger and more. Dismantling white supremacist culture is complicated. For white people, it means looking inside, looking at our own ways of being and noticing how we may be supporting, unintentionally, of course, this culture of white supremacy. It doesn't feel good. We may feel inside a tug of resistance. And here is where I find the term white fragility so useful. It describes something that I felt, but I couldn't adequately explain. It's that thing that happens when someone points out something racist, especially if it's a more subtle form of racism, and a white person like myself responds to it with defensiveness. Oh, that's not really racist. That person didn't mean to be offensive. Or when an instance of racism is cited, and a white person like myself responds to it with guilt. Oh my gosh, that's so awful. I feel so awful that white people like me did that. I'm so sorry that happened. I can't imagine. And on and on and on. Both reactions, defensiveness and guilt, put the focus on the white person's emotional state, drawing the focus away from what should be center stage, the racism and the harm that it causes people of color. White fragility is all that bending over backwards progressive white folks like myself do to convince ourselves and others that we're not racist, which actually gets in the way of the real work of dismantling racism. As some of you know, the term white fragility was coined by academic and educator Robin DiAngelo. Just a second. The term was coined by her, and in fact, she wrote the book. White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism. It's published by our own Unitarian Universalist Beacon Press. DiAngelo points out that the problem, part of the problem, is our binary good-bad thinking. We think there are only two choices: to be racist, which makes you a bad person, or to be not at all racist, which makes you a good person. We progressive UU types who are working really hard to do good in the world, of course, want to align ourselves with the good guys. So it is painful when we think someone is accusing us of being one of the bad guys. This goes for all issues of oppression: sexism, homophobia, colonialism, ableism, classism. We progressive types are against these things. It is intrinsic to our identities that we work against these oppressions. In the good-bad binary paradigm, it is essential to our sense of self that we are identified as on the good side. So we can kind of freak out if we think our goodness is being questioned. We sputter with defensiveness to prove that we are the good guys. DiAngelo gives examples of the kinds of defensive "I'm not racist" statements she hears over and over again in the workshops she leads from white people. Here, there are those in the category of color blindness. "I was taught to treat everyone the same. I don't see color. I don't care if you're pink, blue, or purple polka dotted." And get this one: "I'm not racist. I'm from Canada." There are also those in the category of color celebrate. "I'm not racist because I have people of color in my family. I'm not racist because I work in a very diverse environment. I marched in the 60s. I lived in Japan and was a minority, so I know what it's like to be a minority." The problem is that when a problematic behavior is pointed out, if we put all of our energy into defensive reactions that prove how not racist we are, then we don't spend any energy looking at the problematic behavior that supports the racism which we supposedly despise. We are made impotent by our own defensiveness. DiAngelo proposes that instead of looking at racism as a good-bad binary, we try to see it on a continuum. There are more than those two options, more than bad racist versus good non-racist. DiAngelo says, quote, "I have found it much more useful to think of myself on a continuum. Racism is so deeply woven into the fabric of our society that I do not see myself escaping from that continuum in my lifetime. But I can continually seek to move farther along it. My position is dictated by what I'm actually doing at a given time. Conceptualizing myself on an active continuum changes the question from whether I am or am not racist to a much more constructive question: am I actively seeking to interrupt racism in this context?" End quote. Maybe you have witnessed white fragility yourself. Last spring, I was at a bystander intervention training at First Metropolitan United Church in Victoria that was open to the public. It was a training designed to help participants learn how to intervene in a public instance of racist or anti-Muslim or anti-trans and other forms of oppressive interpersonal harassment or violence. We learned strategies, did role plays, got do and don't tips. On the list of do's, under the category of do take cues from the person being harassed was this one. Notice if the person being harassed is resisting in their own way and honor that. Especially white folks, don't police the tone of the person being harassed. End quote. Immediately, several white folks in the room took issue with that last phrase. Why especially white folks? I think it's racist to single out people like that, they said. I think I understood why the authors put it there. Some of us white folks do have a tendency to, have been trained by our culture to, step up and take control, to try to manage a situation. In so doing, we can inadvertently manage the person with whom we are trying to be in solidarity, which can diminish their agency and personhood. I heard it as a reminder to take the lead of the person with whom I'm trying to be in solidarity, to take cues from them, assist, support, don't police, manage, or control. I thought it was a valid point. But even putting that aside, I was most struck by the tenor of defensiveness in the people who objected. That phrase, white fragility, gave me a name for it. The hypersensitivity to being accused of wrongdoing with regard to race. And instead of trying to understand the behavior noted, why it's problematic and how to avoid it, all the energy goes into defending our fragile white egos. I have seen white fragility. I've also felt it. Usually, hopefully, I catch my white fragility in my own mind before I say something out loud. Someone points out something racist. I notice myself empathizing with the white person in the scenario and start to feel defensive on their behalf. I'm sure they didn't mean to. Now that the concept of white fragility has helped me to identify that defensive reaction within myself, I've taken on a new spiritual practice. With racism, colonialism, transphobia, or any of the other oppressions, when I feel that defensiveness on my own behalf or someone else's, I try to hear it as a meditation bell. Pay attention, it says. Love calls. I don't need to defend or blame. I try to skip over that and turn toward curiosity and learning. What's going on? Why is the behavior problematic? Who does it hurt and how? What can I learn? How can we do better? If you ever decide to try it, to use your own defensiveness as a meditation bell, I would love to hear what you notice. You could try it now as we continue with the service, and if you participate in the after-service discussion, notice your own reactions. Lean into curiosity. Meditation bell at the ready. Let's turn now to microaggressions. This is the other term that I found really useful when I first learned about it about 6 years ago. Again, because it gave a name to something I felt but couldn't adequately describe or explain. Like that cringy feeling I got when I heard Lynn's reflection about the stranger who questioned Lynn about her daughter's ethnicity and the people who asked her daughter directly, "What are you?" Psychologist Darrell Wing Su defines microaggressions as, quote, brief everyday exchanges that send denigrating messages to certain individuals because of their group membership. The message often makes the person feel othered, like they don't belong or are exotic or abnormal in some way. The negative message is often sent unintentionally, and often the person who speaks is unaware of their impact. Furthermore, though each individual instance can be slight, the cumulative effect of enduring these slights again and again and again can be spiritually and psychologically harmful over time. There's a video that likens microaggressions to mosquitoes. Though one bite is annoying, you can deal with it. But when you are swarmed by mosquitoes relentlessly, it becomes insufferable. I will show that video at the discussion afterwards and post it on Facebook. Here are a couple of examples from a resource on microaggressions by Dr. Brea M. Banks. Thank you for this resource to Dar, who leads our Radical Welcome group. Dar has a bunch of other really great resources on microaggressions. Here's just a few examples. Microaggression. You don't look Jewish. Message. All Jewish people look the same. You are so articulate. Message. It's unusual for someone of your race to be intelligent. When I look at you, I don't see color. Impact denies a person of color's racial or ethnic experiences. To an LGBTQ person, I like you, but why do others have to shove it in our faces? Message, the LGBTQ experience is offensive and abnormal. Microaggressions are the subtle ways in which we support oppressions of all kinds without noticing or meaning to. It happens in our Unitarian Universalist congregations. How are defensiveness levels doing? We're doing okay. Love calls. We have always had anti-oppression intentions. Now we are trying to learn to pay attention to our impact as well. Again, it requires moving beyond defensiveness into curiosity and open-hearted listening. At our Unitarian Universalist General Assembly last June, I picked up this really helpful pamphlet, and I have extras if you want one of your own. It has a succinct definition of microaggressions, and it gives these examples of common racial microaggressions in UU spaces. As you listen to each one, consider what the impact of each might be. Not how it's intended, they all have positive intentions, but what might be the unintentional negative message embedded in the subtext? How might it make a person feel othered or demeaned? And how would you explain to another UU who doesn't see the problem? So these are the microaggressions that are spoken to people of color in UU spaces. Where are you really from? You must be new to Unitarian Universalism. You speak English so well. Welcome. Do you want to join the racial justice team? Oh, I just have to touch your child's hair. What might be the unintended impact of each of these statements? And how would you explain that to a UU who doesn't see the problem? We can share our ideas with one another at the discussion after the service. The pamphlet has some suggested practices for people of color, such as self-care and strategies for weathering the storm. It also has suggestions for white allies when witnessing a microaggression. Don't accuse the speaker of being a bad person. Do focus on behavior and why it's problematic. Don't forget to ask the target how they are doing, what they need. They offer these possible ally responses to microaggressions. In the case of an offensive joke or remark, I don't know what you mean by that remark. Could you explain? Or, ouch, those words are really hurtful. Or, I know that comment made me really uncomfortable, to the person being targeted. Are you okay? Microaggressions happen to every group that has a marginalized identity. The more we listen to one another's experiences, the more we help one another understand how these things are harmful, the better allies we can be to one another, the better we will become at aligning our impact with our intentions. You may have heard that 2 weeks from now, we will be welcoming to our pulpit Cree Métis poet, performer, and homilist Michelle Brown, who co-facilitated dialogues on reconciliation and relationship for us and Capital Unitarian Universalists last spring. I'm really excited that we've managed to get her on our preaching docket. Her service title, which is based on the lyrics of a song, is called Beneficiaries of a Genocide. When I heard that title, my white fragility gave a little squawk. That's me. I'm a settler in this land. I am the beneficiary of a genocide. I started to slide down into some mix of guilt, shame, discomfort, and defensiveness. And then I heard that meditation bell. Pay attention. Love calls. My hope for us as we listen to the service and as we continue our ongoing work in truth, healing, and reconciliation is that we can move beyond the good-bad binary, accept that we are on a continuum and that none of us have yet arrived. My hope is that those of us who feel the tug of white fragility, defensiveness, or guilt can turn instead to openness and curiosity so that we are not distracted or derailed from the real work. Love calls. In all of our anti-oppression work, love calls us to turn away from defensiveness and turn toward curiosity. Love calls us to listen, to learn, to stay open, and to stick with it. You will notice our next hymn is called Answering the Call of Love. Its original name, which is still in the songbook, was Standing on the Side of Love. The songwriter, Reverend Jason Shelton, changed the words when people with disabilities explained to him how using the word standing as a metaphor for claiming power was problematic for them. I understand that Reverend Shelton makes his case compellingly in a sermon that he preached about it. I posted a link on our Facebook group. I'll note for now that answering the call of love bypasses the good-bad binary that is implied by standing on the side of love. So that's kind of neat. Let's rise in body or spirit, singing together 1014, 1014. Instead of saying, standing on the side of love, we will sing instead, answering the call of love. If you have a pencil, you can change the words in your hymn book there. Nancy will lead us, answering the call of love.